So welcome, everyone, to our teleseminar today, Thursday, December 15th, 2011, at noon Eastern Time, Demystifying Charity Registration with Tony Martinetti of Martinetti Planned Giving Advisors. As I said, this is Marcia Bloomberg. I will be checking my email account in case you have any technology problems or a question, or if you haven't received the materials that Tony put together. And you can reach me at marcia.bloomberg@gmail.com. It's marcia.bloomberg@gmail.com. So just email me and I will be checking that periodically. I am the one who created Nonprofit Direct, the Nonprofit National Resource Directory, which is a listing of more than 250 consultants, coaches, vendors, and specialists in over 80 categories of service dedicated to helping the nonprofit sector survive and thrive. And Nonprofit Direct is hosting today's teleseminar. This is a paragraph that I always open our teleseminars with because I believe in it so wholeheartedly. The work of the nonprofit sector is essential to the well-being of our society. Millions of Americans rely on you to provide services that support their physical and mental health, their educational aspirations, their religious and spiritual needs, their quest for happiness and fulfillment, their hopes and dreams for themselves, their families, and their communities. In Nonprofit Direct, you'll find those who will partner with you as you guide your organization to the future. And our presenter today is one of the directory's experts. I'd like to remind everybody that Nonprofit Direct offers a nonprofit resource library with a lot of free material on topics such as starting a nonprofit, fundraising, legal issues, governance, and a lot more. And we've just upgraded the format so that it's much easier to use. You can see it at www.nonprofit-direct.com, and you'll see the Nonprofit Resource Library tab. So welcome to all of you who learn more about the ins and outs of charity registration. This is just an introduction to the topic. Tony has lots of experience, and we hope you'll be able to take away at least one tip, concept, or idea. But it's not possible in an hour to provide in-depth training. We do want the call to be as valuable to you as possible, so think about questions that relate to your organization's situation, and Tony will take questions after the presentation. You can help shape the presentation, actually, by asking questions that pertain to your organization's situation or circumstances. So let me tell you a little bit about Tony, and then we'll begin. Tony Martinetti has been serving the needs of nonprofits since 1997 through his work in planned giving and his expertise in charity registration. He's a recognized authority on state charity registration, and he's the author of the e-book, Charity Registration, State-by-State Guidelines for Compliance. He's been quoted on planned giving and on the laws and trends of charity registration in The Wall Street Journal, Dow Jones Newswires, Bloomberg Wealth Manager, Yahoo Finance, The Chronicle of Philanthropy, The Nonprofit Times, and other publications. Tony also does stand-up comedy in New York City, and he hosts Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%, live on Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern, and you can listen in anytime on iTunes. So without further ado, here's Tony.
Thank you very much, Marcia. Welcome, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us. And Nonprofit Direct. I'm going to assume that everybody has the slides that Marcia has available. They're not critical, but they will help a lot. So if you didn't get those for some reason, you should email Marcia right now at marcia.bloomberg, and her last name is B-L-O-O-M-B-E-R-G, at gmail.com, and she'll get those to you, and you can catch up with us. We're going to take a look at what charity registration is, what these laws are all about, why you should be on this call, which is why you should comply with the laws, why this is important, where do you register, and that will lead us very easily to what is a solicitation, lots of different definitions about that and what constitutes solicitation, how you get registered, and as Marcia said, this is an overview, so I can't deal with individual states. Plus, there are so many different states represented on the call, I don't think I could do all of them in an hour. But there's an overview, and there's a lot of principles and processes that are similar across the states, and that's what I'll acquaint you with. And I'll leave you with a plan for how to get going so that you don't feel overwhelmed. There is a pretty simple process for prioritizing, and getting going in your charity registration work. That's the last main substantive area. And then if you want to learn even more, I have a couple of slides on how you can do that, which I call continuing education. And as Marcia said, I'll be happy to take calls at the end. There will, questions at the end. There will be time. If you happen to hear any sirens, that's because I'm coming from New York City, and we have a lot of police and fire up and down the streets all the time. So the sirens are mine, but if I get evacuated, you just won't hear me anymore if the sirens are for our building. So what is charity registration? Really pretty simple. These are the requirements in all the states and also in the District of Columbia that charities register with the state authorities. Typically, it's the Attorney General. A lot of states, it's the Secretary of State. Everywhere that you are soliciting or you be exempt in a state. So you either register where you're soliciting or you be exempt. And throughout, I'm going to refer to the 50 states, but you'll always know that there actually are 51, because if I say 51, then I really should be saying jurisdictions, and that's too many syllables. So 50 states, that includes D.C., because there is a separate set of codes for D.C. In fact, I've dubbed them the worst. Of all the 51 in the country, I think the District of Columbia is the toughest to register in. And California is a close second. I know there's a few people from California. Very close second to California, but D.C. takes it. So why should you comply with the state charity registration laws? First reason is the IRS Form 990, revised about 2 to 3 years ago. It has a couple of explicit questions, one in the main body of the form and one on Schedule G, that ask about your compliance with the state charity registration laws everywhere that you're soliciting. The question in the main form is, you might not recognize it actually if you're not involved in charity registration work. It's question 17 in Part 6 of the form, and it asks where you are required to file the Form 990 that you're filling out. And as I'm going to talk about in several minutes, filing Form 990 is a basic part of charity registration in just about every single state out of the 50. So that's how the IRS is finding out where you're supposed to be registered, because they're asking where are you supposed to be filing their Form 990. In what states are you supposed to be doing that? There are also criminal and civil penalties in a bunch of states. The worst is Florida, where it's actually a third-degree felony to not comply with the laws in Florida. Now, I don't think anybody is ever going to go to prison for not complying with charity registration laws, but there is that possibility. I mean, it could be as much as 5 years. But I hasten to add that nobody's going to be going to prison for this, I'm certain. But there is a potential of fines in Florida and lots of other states. So I've listed a bunch of them there. Some are civil and some are criminal. And some states don't have any penalties at all. We have seen some recent enforcement actions, and I'm going to talk about those in a very brief moment. The enforcement actions that we have seen – oh, it's even quicker than I thought. All right. I thought it was two bullets away. So what have we seen recently? Florida, there was a charity that had an $11,000 annual budget, and they were fined $10,000 for failure to register. It was actually failure to renew. Now, that fine got drastically reduced, I think, down to $1,500. But even for a charity with an $11,000 budget, $1,500 is a lot of money. There was one in Georgia that was late last year. That one got some publicity because it was a city councilman's foundation. He was a city councilman in Atlanta, and it was his foundation that was not in compliance. That one was a $25,000 fine, and I have not seen any press since then about whether that fine ever got reduced. There was also one more recently, a New York charity challenged by New Jersey. And the way the charity got found was actually through a used car salesman. This New York-based charity had someone who was soliciting car donations, and I heard there's at least one person on the call who does this, on behalf of the charity, and that was all well and good, and it was working fine. Then that gentleman who was doing that work, that volunteer work for the charity, moved to North Carolina. But he continued to use the charity's name to solicit the used car donations. Now, at this point, it was not well and good because the charity did not know about it. And what he was actually doing was not giving the cars to the charity. He was bringing them down to North Carolina to sell on his used car lot. Now, the charity certainly was not liable for that because they didn't know that he was, you know, doing these bad things using their name. They had no idea. But the press around it, and I guess it was, you know, it was sort of lighthearted a little bit because it was a used car salesman. And it turned serious when the regulators in New Jersey wondered whether this New York-based charity was registered in New Jersey. And, in fact, they weren't. So there was actually a $17,000 fine against that charity. And the reason I spend a few minutes talking about that one is because it does point out that you just never know how you or some charity might get caught up in charity registration enforcement. That was a situation, as I said, you know, completely unknown to the charity. It was this bad guy using their name, and they ended up with press, and it turned bad for them with respect to the charity registration laws. There is the potential also for board member liability. Your board members are fiduciaries to your organization. That means that they have a legal duty to ensure that your charity is in compliance with laws. And I have seen a case in California where there was an enforcement letter sent to a charity, and in boldface, the letter said that if any fines are imposed on your board members, organization funds may not be used to pay those fines against board members. So that's a case of personal liability. I do not know whether fines were actually imposed, but I did see the a copy of that letter, and I know that that language was in there. There's always the possibility, it's kind of remote, really, but it remains a possibility, and I think about this a lot because I work in planned giving as well as in charity registration. And in planned giving, there's a terrific likelihood that a disgruntled donor or a disgruntled heir to a donor would sometime in the past when a gift was made challenge that gift. And a way that it could be challenged is by saying that the solicitation was illegal because the charity wasn't registered in the state where the solicitation was made. And the way I sort of encapsulate that is a disgruntled donor, or it could be heir, hiring an enterprising attorney. And an enterprising attorney has an incentive to discover ways of challenging a gift, and that's a pretty sound one, actually, claiming that the solicitation was illegal. Finally, it's just the right thing to do, to operate within the laws in the states where we are doing business, where we are soliciting. So we've seen so far what charity registration is and why it's important to comply. Now we're going to take a look at where you register. Very simple. You register everywhere you solicit except where you're exempt. And the natural question that flows from that is, what is a solicitation? And as I said early on, it varies really state by state, but I can put these solicitation definitions into a couple of categories for you. The first is whether if you are doing online giving, if you're accepting gifts online through a Donate Now button on your website. That's characterized as a passive solicitation, and that phrase, passive solicitation, comes from what's called the Charleston Principles. This is a document that I read pretty closely, and actually it's my it's my casual subway reading, actually, the Charleston Principles. I do carry a copy around with me, and from time to time I reread them. I do read books too, but the Charleston Principles are with me actually every day. And they were created by the National Association of State Charity Officials, NASCO, at a meeting in Charleston, South Carolina. That's where they got their name. And it's a set of principles that states are encouraged to follow, and a fair number of states do. It's sort of difficult to tell whether a state adheres to the Charleston principles or not. In most cases, there are a couple of states where you'll see on their website, or if you contact the state officials in the right office, they will tell you that they follow the Charleston principles. But the states where you see it on the website, or where the officials will tell you, is just a small minority of states. It's sort of tough to tell which states adhere to the principles. But if they do, it's a passive. So this Donate Now button is a passive solicitation. And whether they adhere to the Charleston principles or not, I can tell you that the Donate Now button is a solicitation in all the states I've listed there, and a bunch of others. It's about 22 to 25. Again, a couple of states, it's a gray area, so that's why I have to sort of give you a range and some things. It's about between 22 and 25 states, so roughly half the states. If you have a Donate Now button on your website, that button standing alone on the day it goes live is a solicitation. It doesn't matter whether anybody ever clicks it. Doesn't matter whether anybody in a particular state clicks it. This is an important principle. It's not where you're getting fundraising revenue, where your fundraising revenue is coming from, for the most part. I am going to share an exception to that general rule with you later on. But in general, it's not where the revenue is coming from. It's where your solicitation is going out to. And when the Donate Now button is live, it's obviously visible everywhere in the world, and it is a solicitation in about half the states. So that's an important principle. Think about where you're soliciting out to, not where your fundraising revenue is coming from, for the most part. Again, an exception later on. Second category of solicitation is when you have that Donate Now button and you're inducing people to it. And you might do that in any of the ways that I have listed there, email, U.S. mail, et cetera. But it's the combination now of the Donate Now button and an inducement to it. Now, under the Charleston principles, that's an active solicitation. And you can see the difference. The website, the Donate Now button being live, is a pretty passive thing. But in combination with an inducement to go to it, that's sounds more active, right? And so it is called an active solicitation. And that's an active solicitation. So that brings in the previous states where the Donate Now button alone was enough. And now you bring in these additional six states. And now you can see in Texas, I say not email. So if you're inducing people in Texas using email to go to your website and click the Donate Now button, that is not a solicitation. But in Texas, the other methods of inducing people to that Donate Now button would be a solicitation. And you can see that the more you get into the details, the more these neat categories that I've created start to break down. Next slide on what a solicitation is. Asking for charitable support by any of these methods, whether you're having people go to your Donate Now button, or whether you're asking them to send a check, or whether you're having them even donate to a community foundation, you're doing the solicitation. And these things, including that last bullet, buying an advertisement, advertising space, these are a solicitation in nearly every state. And the only reason I have that little qualification nearly is because I'm just reluctant to say that anything applies everywhere. It is, these rules are such a morass, 50 different sets. It probably is every state, but the way things change from time to time, I'm just hedging a little bit and saying nearly every state. But if you're doing these things, odds are very strong that, or any one of them, that you're soliciting in the state where you're doing them or where you're hosting them. And that would be irrespective of whether you have a Donate Now button or not. So if you're not, you know, if you had a Donate Now button and you weren't sure in some states whether that was a solicitation, if you were doing one of these other activities, then it wouldn't matter what that state thought of your Donate Now button, because these standing alone are sufficient. These would be enough to draw you into this web of regulation. If you are soliciting, then there is a potential way out, as you saw in one of my early slides where it was, you know, what is charity registration? You may be exempt, depending on a couple different different factors. You could be exempt in a bunch of states. The exemptions really do vary quite dramatically across the states. Some states have no exemptions. Some states have just one or two, and some states have a lot. They fall into, as I said, different categories, and the first that's most common is by mission. Education is a very common exemption. Healthcare is another one. Religion. But they always come with qualifications. You'll never see something that says all healthcare institutions are exempt. And those qualifications are typically around accreditation when it's education or healthcare. You have to be accredited by a recognized authority. Those are really the most common mission, aside from when you get to really small charities like fire, police, emergency services. Another very popular one is a group that's raising money for a benefit of an individual, you know, someone who's stricken with cancer or someone who's lost everything in a fire. Those types of solicitations are also very common. And I'm going to guess that just about everybody on the call falls into the middle of that spectrum. I mean, the very large, you know, healthcare and education on one side, and the very small fire, police, raising money for an individual on the small side of the spectrum. Most charities are somewhere in between. So for those in between, there are other possibilities of exemption. Gross revenue. The states that have gross revenue exemptions, it'll typically be like in the $15,000 to $25,000 range. So if your gross revenue is below that threshold, then you can be exempt in that state. And then there's another category, gross fundraising revenue. Same concept, but now just narrower. So you're putting aside any fee for services or other sources of revenue that you might have. And what I believe is the kindest and I think the most appropriate type of exemption is revenue from within the state. You would have to calculate how much you get from an individual state that might have this exemption, and if you're below their threshold, you wouldn't have to register in that state. And the reason I think it's the most appropriate is because that's really what the state's interest is. What are you doing in our state, and how much are you actually raising from our state? But that also happens to be the smallest or the least common, I should say. I'm sorry. It's the least common exemption. Revenue from within the state, it's just a handful of states. Like, I think three have that exemption.
Tony, this is Marcia. I'm hearing a little bit of background noise, so I'm going to mute our participants until it's time for Q&A.
Okay.
That means you're bad
pupil? You're being muted?
Right. No, they're not bad at all. It's just that there's a little background noise. So hopefully they can still hear you and me.
I'm sure. Okay. This is cool. This is the modern equivalent of masking tape.
Exactly.
Now we're moving to how do you register? I'll look at some forms and documentation and fees. And, of course, we will be taking the masking tape off at the end. There will be time for questions at the end. So how do you register using forms, basically? As so many other areas in charity registration varies considerably across the states, there is a unified registration statement, or URS, and that is accepted by 35 or 37 of the states. I forget exactly. That is very helpful, the unified registration statement, because it's a common form, and you just have to fill out a couple of different variables or a couple of different fields on the form differently, like what state are you submitting it to and when did your activities start in this state. But aside from a couple of questions, the form is exactly the same for all the other states where you can submit it, and that is very, very helpful. You do want to know, though, that a lot of states have their own little idiosyncrasies that come out so that in addition to the URS, they'll have additional forms for you to fill out. So the main form would be that unified registration statement, but a lot of states have another one or two forms that they've added in because the states, I've learned in spending about 4 years with this, cannot suppress their identities. Their idiosyncrasies have to come out, and they get them out by adding forms to the unified form for the states that accept it. So that really covers the first two bullets there. There are some states that accept just the unified registration statement. That's very nice. Then there's unified registration plus some additional state forms. And then there are states where the unified registration statement is not accepted. And those are the states where you're registering as a foreign corporation doing business. And I'm going to take a step back and fill all this in for you. What I've been talking about so far is registering under Charity Solicitation Acts. Now, they're not called that in every single state. As I've said, you know, personalities have to come out. Things do vary considerably across the states. But generally, it's something like a Charitable Solicitation Act or something around close to that. That's the body of law that you're registering in, and in most states, and that's what I've been talking about so far. Now, you are each a nonprofit corporation. You are incorporated in one state. You can only be incorporated in one state. That may be the state where you're located, but doesn't have to be. But you're incorporated in just one state as a nonprofit corporation. And in that state, you are considered a domestic corporation. In every other state, you are a foreign corporation, because you're not incorporated in any other state. So that leads to this second category of charity registration. You're a foreign corporation doing business in some state. I believe that soliciting charitable gifts is doing business. There are a lot of people who do what I do and think that charitable solicitation is not doing business. So they would advise you that you do not have to register in those foreign corporation doing business states, and there are about 13 of them. So I want you to know that I'm risk averse. I counsel our clients when there's a gray area or it's uncertain, register. When there's a 30% chance of rain, I'm the guy walking around with an umbrella. It may not be open, but I'm carrying it around. So I tend to be very risk averse. But as I said, there are practitioners, including attorneys, other attorneys, who think that, who have the opinion that, I don't mean to minimize it, who have the opinion that soliciting is not doing business. And so they would advise that you don't have to register in those 13 foreign corporation doing business states. And if you have questions about that, I'll be happy to answer them at the end. Documentation around registration. I've listed a bunch of the typical documents that are requested by most states. They almost all want what's called your organic documents, the documents that gave life to your organization when you incorporated it. Those are your bylaws and your articles of incorporation. The tax-exempt letter is the one that would have come from the Internal Revenue Service telling you that you are qualified as a 501c3 charity, and so that gifts to your charity are deductible for income tax purposes. A list of board members, that can get a little intrusive, actually. There are some states where they only want a list of names, but they also want, in some states, it's even actually home addresses. And social security numbers. Georgia stands out because we just had this back and forth with a client about Georgia. Georgia actually does ask for social security numbers of board members. And we try to negotiate around that, but have not been successful. So there are some states where it gets a little intrusive. Others, it's not intrusive. It's just a list of the names and their business addresses. Financial reports, that will vary in a lot of states depending on your revenue. So, say in some states, if your gross revenue is, I'm generalizing, let's say $250,000 or above, then you would have to provide an audited financial statement. And if your gross revenue was, say, $100,000 to $250,000, then you would have to provide a financial statement with an accountant's opinion letter, which is a lesser standard than a full audit. And if your revenue was below $100,000, then it might just be financial statement. So that you do see different categories of financial statements and what has to accompany them in a lot of states based on your revenue. And finally, the IRS Form 990, as I said very early on, required by probably every state, since my hesitation again to say every state. I'm just never comfortable saying it applies everywhere. But it is very, very common to request that the Form 990 or the 990EZ if you're below the 990 filing threshold and you file the EZ, then they'll, of course, accept a copy of that. And that sub-bullet is what I referred to earlier. That's how the IRS asks about your compliance with state laws, because they're asking in which states are you required to file your Form 990. And I think that's interesting because it's a federal agency asking about your compliance with state laws. Registration fees fall into a few categories. There are the flat fee states. Some are very inexpensive, as little as $15. Some are higher. Most fall into the, you'll see the last bullet, 32 states are under $100. So it's in most of the states, it's not very expensive to register. After flat fees, then you might see fees that are tiered by your gross revenue or just your contribution revenue. And the final category of fees, which, again, I believe is the kindest and the most appropriate, tiered by your revenue from that state. But as you might guess, that's only a handful of states that base the fees on your in-state revenue. Hawaii is the most expensive. That happens to be a tiered state, so that's why I say $750 for the largest. So everybody does not pay $750 in Hawaii. I listed the five free states, and as I said, most states are $100 or less. So that's what we've covered so far, what it is, why you should comply, where you register, what a solicitation is, how you register. So I want to leave you with a plan for getting going on your registration work. Step one is register in your home state. I hope you're all registered in your home state. You really need to be if you're not. That is a very, very high priority. That's where almost all the enforcement actions that I've seen have come from. As I said, there was that New York charity that got caught by New Jersey over the used car salesman. But most of the enforcements have been home state actions. I mentioned earlier, I explained the Florida one, the Georgia one, Arizona and Washington. Those were just mass mailings to charities in the state by the regulators in each of those two states to the charities that were not registered in those states. So definitely register in your home state. I think it's very risky for you not to be registered in your home state. After that, here's the exception that I alluded to earlier. If you do have very high fundraising revenue from one or two states that are not your home state, I do think it's a good idea to register in those states. And I say that because those states could decide that they have an interest. Even though these are charity solicitation laws and you might not be soliciting as much in one or two states where you might have some very, even maybe just one very large donor or a couple of large donors. But I think a state's interest rises when you have a lot of revenue coming from that state, a lot of fundraising revenue. So that's why my advice is, look to see whether that applies to you. And you'd be looking at either a gross dollar amount or a percentage. I wish very much that I could give you a dollar amount that constitutes very high or a percentage that constitutes very high. That's not possible because it varies incredibly across the states. And this idea comes from the Charleston Principles. This is not my idea. It's in the Charleston Principles, and in those principles, they encourage states to select an exact dollar amount or an exact percentage that state has set as a matter of policy that would trigger the state's interest. But even the Charleston Principles don't go so far as to pick those numbers for the states. They just encourage the states to pick their own. So you're sort of on your own to decide whether $10,000 is a lot from a state, or if you think $50,000 is a lot coming from a single state, or if you think $1,000 is a lot coming from a state, or similarly what the percentage might be. Is if 10% of all your revenue comes from one state, is that a lot, or does it really need to be a third? Those questions I really can't be any more precise on, but I do encourage you to look to see whether you have high fundraising revenue states. Next step is if you're doing web-based fundraising. So if you have the Donate Now button that I talked about earlier. First question to ask, do you need that Donate Now button to be active in all the 50 states? Or are there just a handful of states where you get online donations from? If that's the case, then put an explicit statement right on your giving page that says, we only accept donations from California and Oregon. I assume that would be either a Southern Oregon or a Northern California charity. And I like to go a step further. If you can, technologically, if you can restrict the states in the drop-down menu on your online giving page, if you can eliminate states, then take out all the states where you don't want to receive online donations from, because you've already decided you don't need them in those states. You're not getting online fundraising revenue from any of these other states. So just make that drop-down list the few states that you've decided you get revenue from. And then it's impossible for someone in another state to make a gift because they can't get their state into your online giving form. Now, That second part, the monitoring the or restricting the states, again, that's me being risk averse. It's probably okay to just have the disclaimer statement, we only accept gifts from whatever states. But I like to go a step further and actually make it impossible for someone to give online from any other state. Again, my risk aversion. Now, I know you might not have control over that. You know, if you're accepting online donations from PayPal, you don't have that possibility of restricting the states. And there may be other reasons you don't. But if you can, I like to see both. And, you know, even if this applies maybe in just, well, in more than just a handful of states, maybe it's a dozen states that you get fundraising revenue from, or, I'm sorry, you get online revenue from. Even then, that's better than the almost half the states where that Donate Now button standing alone is a solicitation. So if you can restrict it to 10 or 12 or 15 states, it's still better than the 22 to 25 states where the Donate Now button standing alone is a solicitation. So that's a very good tip. And that also comes from the Charleston Principles. It's kind of buried in there. You have to read them on the subway every day like I do to see it, but it's there. And so it's not my original idea, but it's a very, very good one, and it can save a lot of headache where you have the Donate Now button if you're just getting online revenue from a few states. Then you want to look at where you are soliciting the most, and that's going to be based on state population, because your Donate Now button is visible by more people in the state of Texas than in the state of Connecticut, because there are more people living in Texas than Connecticut. So at this point, you're just looking at state census lists. So you look at census.gov, and in the higher population states, your Donate Now button is seen by more people, so those become the higher priority states for you to register in. You work down the list because you sort the list by descending state population. Highest populations are on the top. For non-web-based fundraising, so you don't have to worry about your Donate Now button. You don't have to worry about having a Donate Now button. You're also interested in where you solicit the most. But here you have the information yourself. You don't have to go to the Census Bureau. You know where your constituents live or where you're sending the mail to. So query your own database for where your constituents live in terms of frequency by state. Order the list in a descending sequence and start your registrations up at the top, because those are the states where you're sending the most solicitations out. And my final slide on how to get going is just some encouragement. Don't be overwhelmed by this. You may decide that you have to register in a lot of states. Just take it a little bit at a time. There's no way you can register in, well, unless you have somebody dedicated to this full time, and I'm going to presume that none of you do. There's no way that somebody doing this as a part of their responsibilities can take on more than, I think, three in a month. And in a lot of places, for a lot of smaller organizations, even that's too many. So I say devise a plan. You're going to do one or two or three per month, and you've prioritized the way I described on the first few slides in this subject. You've got a priority list. Just follow the priority list and just work down. Remember that you might be exempt in some states, but also that you have to apply for exemption in some states. There are a good number of states where the exemption, once you've determined that you fit within it, means you just walk away. You have nothing more to do in that state. But there are also a good number of states where you have to ask for the exemption. You believe you qualify for it, but you have to ask, and your exemption has to be approved. So you just want to be aware of that. And, you know, it's eminently doable. It can be done. We do them for clients that don't want to do them on their own, but I wrote a book for charities that want to do it on their own. It can be done. Don't be intimidated. Just follow a plan. If you want
to
know,
okay, Tony, I'm going to open up the lines if that's okay with you for Q&A.
Okay, well, let me just not quite.
Go ahead.
A little continuing education. Just acquaint people with what's on the two continuing ed slides. NASCONET, that's that National Association of State Charity Officials. They're the ones that devised the Charleston Principles. Have their site there for you. You'll get information about the Unified Registration Statement at multistatefiling.org. If you want to get more information from me, I listed my blog there. I host a radio show for nonprofits, as Marcia said earlier. The show is not devoted to charity registration. I can't imagine a show lasting more than one show. If I announced that every week we were going to talk about charity registration, I can't imagine the show lasting into a second week. So the show is not devoted to charity registration, but I do talk about it sometimes. And Marcia asked me to tell you what's coming up this week on my show. I have John Hayden. He's the principal of Inbound Zombie and co-author of Facebook Marketing for Dummies. And actually, he's in the Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I know we have Ivy on the call. I know Ivy said earlier that she's from Cambridge. John Hayden is going to talk about Facebook fundamentals. If you're not on Facebook, how do you get there? How do you do fundraising on Facebook? How do you meld Facebook with your other channels? How do you use their analytics? And my second guest on the show is Scott Kegler. He is the editor of Nonprofit Technology News. He's on with me once a month. He's my regular technology for nonprofits contributor, and he's going to be talking about your fresh-faced website. How do you know when you need to freshen up or update your website, and what should you be thinking about when you do that? Those are my guests this Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern, and the show is also archived on iTunes. You'll find the iTunes archive at nonprofitradio.net, nonprofitradio.net. And I'm on all the social media that you see listed there. You can find me there. And the last slide is the title of my book and where you would find that book if you wanted state-by-state instructions for how to do charity registration. Okay, Marcia, now...
Ready? You ready? I'm going to unmute everyone.
Okay, the tape has been removed.
And, Tony, we already have a question that came in via email from Jim Maloney. And he says, in association with membership, if you solicit just your members, how does this apply?
Yeah, so he snuck the question in by email. That was very, very, very good thinking. You were muted, but you snuck it in. There are states that have exemptions for soliciting members only. That is not in every state. As I've said, I think, two or three times, nothing applies to every state in charity registration. So you will not find that exemption in every state, but there are a good number of states that do restrict or that do exempt charities that restrict their solicitations to members.
Okay, he also mentions organizations without members, but they have constituents or followers. How does that apply if everyone has contacted the association to receive information or benefit and they are the only ones solicited for support?
Well, I would say if they're not a member, then they don't fall within that membership exemption. You always want to look to see whether there's some other category of exemption that you might fit in. But the way he described it, I don't hear one.
Okay. And he says, what really constitutes inducement?
Any of those methods that I listed on the slide, encouraging people to go to the website. So an email, an advertisement, saying it at a meeting or an event. If you're encouraging people to go, that's an inducement. I'm not saying you have to, you know, be saying that there's some prize if you go. It's not like that at all. Just if you're encouraging people to go by any of the methods that I mentioned, phone is also another one. If you're encouraging people to go to your Donate Now button, that's what I mean by inducement.
Okay, and Jim has one last question.
Oh, my gosh, four-part question. Okay.
I'm sorry. Estimated costs for filing in all states has been given is $12,000, which includes fees, legal fees, et cetera. Is that true or false, and is it a realistic estimate?
Read it again. What is he including in that $12,000 number?
He is including fees and legal fees. I don't know what the other fees might be.
Fees are going to depend on the size of the organization. I can't generalize for a particular organization and say, I just can't do it because it depends. So many states depend on what your revenue is. Legal fees, if you have a law firm doing this, no, I would say that $12,000 would not be anywhere near enough to get a law firm to register you in all 50 states. You'd probably be 4 to 5 times that for a law firm, the way law firms have to bill hourly. Okay, is there a question from anybody other than Jim?
Yes, Ivy.
Hi, Ivy in Cambridge. How are you doing?
Indeed. I will try not to do four, but I did have a couple questions. One is that some of our funders, and I know they're doing this in multiple states, are setting up websites where they, try and be a resource for other funders to find nonprofits. So, for instance, I know the United Way in New Haven, Connecticut set up one. The Boston Foundation is setting up one for Massachusetts, and they are putting, hundreds or thousands of nonprofits up on a website and then having donate now buttons for those nonprofits. So my question is it their responsibility, and if they are the pass-through for the donation, is it still on each of those individual nonprofits to be registered? If someone, for instance, went to the, United Way website in their state, or in a different state, made a donation and went to the United Way and distributed that out to a nonprofit?
Right. I think I understand. It's a murky area. There are states where the way you described it, that United Way registering would be sufficient.
Okay.
I would say, too, for anybody who might be participating in something like what Ivy is describing, make sure they're properly registered. Due diligence. When you start some kind of a collaboration with another organization of any type, obviously corporate or charitable, make sure you do your due diligence. They're registered. Did they renew? We didn't, we didn't really have time to talk about renewals, but did they register initially, and are they current? In a lot of states, you have to renew your registration every year. Have they done that? So, you just want to make sure you do your due diligence and not just have them say, oh, we're registered. Okay, check mark, that item is covered. It may or may not be. And then there are states where the individual charities might have to register. It becomes sort of fact-sensitive, too, and I can't get into the facts with you, Ivy, but I'll give you some generalizations.
Yep.
If from that United Way they're directing you over to the charity's website where the Donate Now button is, that would make it – I'd be more inclined in that case to say that the charity would have to register. But if it's a combined Donate Now button and then somewhere on the United Way site you select the charity that you're giving to, I'd be less inclined to say the individual charity – has to register. But again, I'm saying more inclined and less inclined. There are no definites charity registration. And in the murky area that you're asking about, it really becomes very fact specific.
Gotcha.
Did you have one? You want to do one more follow-up?
Sure. Do you want to say something about international? Is that going to be something we have to worry about eventually?
I'm just going to be honest and say it's outside my expertise. I don't know. I have never found anything in Puerto Rico about charity registration, and I have looked extensively. But other countries, I can't speak to it at all.
Yep.
I'm having enough trouble keeping our 50 straight.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Ivy.
More
Tony?
Questions for Tony. Go ahead.
Tony, this is Ron. I'm down in Atlanta. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Ron.
Good. You've helped clarify a lot of this because we're really in a startup kind of thing because I'm a brain tumor survivor and we're trying to raise money for brain tumor research. And the complications, here are just astounding. For instance, Marcia, I just sent you an email. If you talk to First Giving or Network for Good, they're considered a pass-through But then it does get kind of complicated because we had someone ask us to do something up in the state of Washington, and when we talked to people there, they told us we should file and register, even though we would be collecting funds through a First Giving webpage.
Mm.
First Giving and Network for Good, I mean, you, when you ask them, it's very, very confusing, and I love the word murky because it is.
Yeah, it's very similar to what Ivy's describing. Look, and that's, you know, I've chosen to be risk averse. Ron, my advice would be, if you're not sure, register.
That's
the same advice I give
all
our
registration
clients. Yeah, I think that's, well, it's definitely the safest course. There's no question about that. I think it's prudent. Yeah.
No, I agree with you, because what we felt was that if we're going to be working in that state, we register in that state. Until we work in the state, then we'll register.
Okay.
It makes more sense. It really does.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Ron. Thank you.
Another question for Tony?
Where do you find the...
Who's this?
Where do you find the exemption list?
Who am I talking to?
This is Christy with mylifeline.org. I didn't get a chance to introduce myself at the beginning.
Okay, Christy. The exemptions are in the state statutes. They are also, in a lot of states, you'll find them on the website. Some state websites are very helpful around charity registration, and some don't exist. You can't find anything about registration, so you have to actually go to the statutes. Those are the places to find the exemption criteria. If it's not on the website, you have to go to the statutes. And that's why in my book, actually, I give references for the statutes, so you don't have to go find them. I did that legwork.
Okay, great.
Okay, thanks, Christy.
Thank you.
Other questions? Tony, this is Marcia. You mentioned that organizations would have to register each year. Is that correct?
In a lot of states, yes. You have to renew each year. There are a couple of states where the renewal is every other year, like Georgia stands out in my mind as one that's every 2 years. And then there are some states where the registration is indefinite. You just do it once, and that's it. It's good indefinitely. The renewals are typically a lot easier than the registrations. Usually what you have to provide in the renewal is your board list, and your updated financial statement. That's pretty typical of renewals. But, of course, okay. You know, they do vary across the states. And, again, there are some states where you do not have to renew.
And since you've written a book on the topic, and this is a complex topic, would you let people know where they can purchase the book?
Yeah, it's on the very last slide. The URL is statecharityregistration.com.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we are approaching the end of our session, and I want to thank you, Tony, for really shedding some light on what is a murky situation, and hopefully people will feel the impetus to go ahead and do some research and register their organizations. We do have another teleseminar coming up, not this year, but next year, Thursday, January 12th, 2012, at noon Eastern, How Leadership Coaching Can Enhance an Organization. And it's with Jeff Metz with Bloom Metz Consulting. So if folks are interested in other teleseminars, you can find the list of those upcoming at www.nonprofit-direct.com/teleseminars. And I promised Tony that I would let everyone know that we're sending out a post-teleseminar survey that helps us know how we did today and what other topics you might be interested in the future. Tony, did you want to say something about the survey?
Yeah, please. Marcia said you're going to get that link to the survey this afternoon, and please do fill it out. I would really be grateful if you got something from this, even if you think I'm a lousy speaker, but if you got something from this, I'd really be grateful if, in turn, you would fill out the survey, because I take feedback about my presentations very seriously. So it really would mean a lot to me, therefore I'd be grateful if you would fill out that survey. And if you filled it out this afternoon, it's really the best, because everything is fresh in your mind.
Terrific. And again, thank you, Tony. Thank you, everyone, for joining us at today's session. I want to wish everyone happy holidays and a happy new year, and we hope that we'll see you back in 2012. Take care.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony.